Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The Wisconsin Badgers podcast comes to you with some sad tidings. It was not a good weekend for Wisconsin sports in general. It was not a good weekend for the University of Wisconsin football team, which lost to BYU, a stunning upset at Camp Randall Stadium in week three of the season. 24-21, Wisconsin was able to get off a field goal attempt in the final seconds, but Rafael Gaglianone's kick was wide, leaving BYU with one of those. Every year there's a few teams, few top 10, top 5 teams that go down in some stunning upsets. That, in this case, was unfortunately the Wisconsin Badgers, as they saw their long non-conference winning streak snapped. They probably are no longer quite thinking about the college football playoff the way they might have been coming into the year, but the Big Ten season does begin next week, which means the Badgers still have a chance to right the ship and do some pretty impressive things this season. There's always a chance at the end of the year, if they somehow run the table, win the Big Ten, there could still be a spot for them at the table. It's not something you can quite yet rule out, but it definitely this was definitely a dark chapter in Badgers football history. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. I am the host of the Wisconsin Badgers Journal Sentinel podcast. I'm going to be joined in a minute by Jeff Patricus, Journal Sentinel beat reporter, covering the Badgers, trying to look at all the different things basically that went wrong this week. The offense, the defense, the special teams. There was not much of a silver lining coming from this game in which the Badgers, you know, struggled throughout. This wasn't a late rally by any means. They went to halftime tied at 14. The Cougars really just played well across the board. I mean, they were able to hit a big time double pass play from Oliva Hifo to a wide open receiver in Maroni Lualu Putuatu. I think I said that incorrectly, but gave it my best shot. That was a big play in the game that allowed BYU to take the lead at that point. There was a big interception by quarterback Alex Hornibrook of the Badgers that set up another BYU scoring play. And then they got a big field goal late in the game that turned out to be the difference. And Skylar Southam hits the field goal from 45 yards out. The Badgers do get down the field. They do get an opportunity for Gaglianone to become to be the hero yet again. He's got 4 game-winning kicks on his ledger, but like we said, it went wide left. Before we talk to Jeff Patricus, I wanted to do a couple housekeeping items. Please find the Wisconsin Badgers podcast at Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a rating, give us a review, and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear back from you guys. You can find me on Twitter at JR Radcliffe. That's JRRADCLIFFE. You can also find Jeff Patricus at JAYPO1961, JAYPO1961. And let us know what you think of the podcast. Always helps getting feedback. It also increases our reach a little bit. This is only the 4th episode ever of the Wisconsin Badgers podcast. We're still trying to get it off the ground. So please tell your friends, give a review, give a rating, and let us know what you think. Also, want to let you know then that next week I've been doing these live blogs, the Wisconsin Badgers live blogs for the Journal Sentinel from Camp Randall. Not going to be there next week at Kinnick Stadium in Iowa, sticking to just the home game schedule as planned. So unfortunately, will not be with you that way for the next couple weeks, but we still intend on having the podcast next week. The full coverage of that Badgers-Iowa game will be available at jsonline.com. You'll, of course, be wanting to read some of the stories leading into the week as the Badgers try to pick up the pieces and figure out what happened in this game. Running down the stats, we see Alex Hornibrook was 18 of 28 passing for 190 yards, and that interception, he did not throw a touchdown. The interception was really tough. That was definitely something that turned the tables. Third quarter sets up a score similar to the New Mexico game. They had a big interception, but the defense held, got a big turnover in return. That did not happen on this day. Jonathan Taylor ran the ball 26 times for 117 yards. Still, the team really struggled on third down plays. They've got some pretty good running backs. I mean, Tywan Deal also looks really good at times. He had two touchdowns, actually. He only ran 6 times for 15 yards, but got in the end zone a couple times. But still, the Badgers just weren't able to convert. I believe it was 4 of 13 on third down, which is unusual for a team with this power running attack. Jake Ferguson, the tight end, caught 3 balls for 61 yards. One of the kind of fringe bright spots, I guess, in this game. Danny Davis was back from his 2-game suspension. He caught 4 balls for 40 yards. Talked to Jeff Patricus about Davis's debut. You'll be interested to hear what he has to say about that. A.J. Taylor, who was a big factor last week against New Mexico, 2 catches. For 31 yards. On defense, Ryan Connolly led the attack, 4 tackles. Caesar Williams also with 4. Dakota Dixon with 4. Dixon did take responsibility for that double pass play that left a man wide open for a touchdown that turned out to be a pretty big play in the game. Nobody really did well on defense. It wasn't the worst defensive performance in terms of points all time, with, you know, 24 points not being the end of the world, but the defense just was not able to hold BYU in check. And this is without quarterback Tanner Mangum really lighting it up. He was 12 of 22 for 89 yards, but he wasn't throwing the ball downfield. I mean, they did have the trick play with Hefo throwing the pass for 31 yards and a touchdown. But Squally Canada ran 11 times for 118 yards and 2 touchdowns, gouged them with big plays, averaged 10 yards, more than 10 yards a carry, which is not ideal. Hefo, the guy who threw that trick pass, 5 carries for 45 yards. Again, that's 9 yards a carry. I mean, that's a surprising volume for a team that, you know, didn't necessarily go crazy through the air. Shione Takitaki was just a beast on defense. I mean, they've got some pretty good players on defense. Corbin Kafusi's 6'9", just a terrifying DN who's, I'm guessing, going to play in the NFL. But Takitaki led the way, led BYU with 8 tackles, including a sack. Chris Wilcox was in there. Zane Anderson made some big plays. He had the interception. So definitely a tough one, a tough loss. The Badgers not used to being beaten on their home turf in any capacity, but certainly not by a non-conference team, especially after smoking BYU last year on the road with a lot of similar personnel this year, especially on offense. Just could not get it done. Let's get to Jeff Patricus. He'll get us caught up on everything we need to know about this team and about this tough game. Here now is Jeff Patricus, Wisconsin Badgers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He and I were both watching the game Saturday that I know caught a lot of people by surprise, and BYU, of course, pulling the upset over the Badgers. Jeff, I kind of, just off the top, what's the best case scenario for the Badgers going forward? It feels like the CFP is completely off the table. If they run the Big Ten, is it possible to still get back into the conversation?
Yeah. The college football playoff, it's September 16th, according to my calendar. It's to say that anyone's in or anyone's out is way premature at this point. The best case scenario for them has to be a victory at Iowa this week, because if you go back to the 2015 season, they opened with Iowa in Madison. It was Paul Chryst's first year. Iowa came in, didn't do much on offense, but had a really just took enough took advantage of Wisconsin's offensive mistakes, won a 10-6 game, and parlayed that victory into the Big Ten West title. And then eventually a spot in the Rose Bowl when they lost Michigan State. So you got to beat Iowa this week because they appear to be your greatest threat to win the West. And then you take it from there after that and see where you end up if you get into Indianapolis.
This game was obviously a struggle kind of in all three aspects of the game. Is there one thing that stands out as particularly troubling or unexpected? You know, 24 points allowed might be a lot for this defense, but still probably puts the offensive position, which is a vaunted offensive position, to do enough. Was it the offense, or was it something else that really caught your eye?
They never should allow 24 points to that BYU team. I mean, BYU, Wisconsin had given up one big play, and that's of 20 yards or more, and that was a coverage bust for a pass. Squally Canada came in averaging 3.7 yards per carry. He had almost as many rushing yards against Wisconsin as he did in his first 2 games combined. BYU does not have an explosive offense, but they hit UW with 4 big plays. The issues on defense were alarming for a number of reasons. One, you saw the front 7 lose the battle physically at times. You saw linebackers out of gaps. For example, on both of Canada's long runs, On the first one, T.J. Edwards had a chance to stop it for a two-yard gain, missed a tackle. On the second one, it appeared that Ryan Conley, the 46-yard run, which set up the game-winning field goal, it appeared that Ryan Conley went too far outside, and Edwards got stuck inside, which helped open up a natural seam for Canada. They should never give up that many big plays that often. So you had physical issues. You had linebackers out of gaps. You had Dakota Dixon talking about his missed call or erroneous defensive call on the touchdown pass, the double pass, the lateral and the pass. Those are things that shouldn't happen to some veteran guys, and that's probably jumps out more than anything.
Yeah, and you had said this before the game, they don't have receivers that can really stretch the field, which makes Canada's performance all the more surprising that he was able, and several runs right up the middle, like he was able to really gash them when they didn't have receivers running up and down the field making big plays. So that was surprising. I'm just blown away that they never really figured it out. They never locked in for some reason.
Well, the first run came against a 2-4-5, which a lot of teams, if they see you in a two down with two down linemen on the field, they're going to try to run at you. But it wasn't blocked so well that Wisconsin couldn't have stopped it. I mean, like I said, Edwards is right near the hole at the 32 to make a tackle for a 2-yard gain. Just didn't get him. The second one was against the 3-4 look, and the end on that side, Lyles, and the nose tackle, Sangapolu, got walled down to the inside, and that also helped create that seam. So it was just physical problems and guys not in their gaps. And that's generally uncharacteristic of this unit, you know, whether it's Leonard as the coordinator, Wilcox as the coordinator, Dave Aranda as a coordinator. It happened Saturday. It's uncharacteristic, but it cost them.
Was there anything you thought BYU did that they just weren't expecting or could account for it? Maybe it's those guys on defense. I know they knew Kafuzi was a good player. Maybe Itaki Taki having the game he had. Was there anything that surprised you that you weren't expecting from the Cougars?
They had more success. Well, the two big runs between the tackles you wouldn't have expected. They beat Wisconsin to the edges early in the game, and particularly in the first half on some of the jet sweeps. But if you look back on it, here's where the injury situation comes in. You know, before the season, I wrote and talked about the fact that one of the key questions on defense is outside linebacker productivity, because you had one proven guy, that was Andrew Van Ginkel. And Andrew Van Ginkel went out early yesterday. It looked like he rolled an ankle, his right ankle, covering a play in the flat. And then we saw him in a boot after the game. So you had guys, you know, for a good portion of that game, you had Zach Bourne and Christian Bell as your two outside linebackers. And in most years, Christian Bell wouldn't have been on the field. So you don't have a lot of guys making plays, and that contributed to the problems as well.
Yeah, obviously I was going to ask about Van Ginkel, not just him getting hurt, but going out so early. I mean, they basically didn't have him the whole day. And also Xander Neville. I mean, he's a guy that's key to the blocking scheme. And we saw the team struggle to convert third down, some short yardage plays. I mean, Xander Neville's a big part of that, and they just got him back. His injury probably was sort of one of those unseen things. You wouldn't have known how impactful that was until you saw it in practice.
Well, actually, you knew because of what happened last year when he went out. I mean, he tore up his knee in the regular season finale at Minnesota. It affected their ability to run the ball and just block certain guys against Ohio State in the Big Ten championship game. Now, they did a better job against Miami because Miami's front wasn't as good as Ohio State's. But Xander Neville is just, as Michael Dieter has said whenever I've asked him about it, is he's a sixth offensive lineman. And what they did yesterday at times was they brought in redshirt freshman Logan Bruss, a reserve right tackle, to be like a jumbo lineman. Now, Bruss is going to be a nice player. They really like him. But he's a young kid who just is not the dominant blocker Neville is. And you talk about, you know, once Neville's out, you got Penniston and Ferguson as your top two tight ends. And Kyle Penniston, he jumped on what was a fourth and one play, turned it into a fourth and six play, and they were in no man's land. They weren't going to kick a field goal or punt, so they went for it and they didn't convert it.
Speaking of that blocking scheme, we saw some new faces, not new faces, but some rotations on the offensive line yesterday. Micah Kapoy, Erdman in the game. Bo Benchwell actually indicated that was part of the plan after the game. I don't know. It seemed surprising at the time. Do you think that was a reaction of what the coaching staff was seeing with the blockers on the offensive line? And I guess what's your impression, Ben, of that offensive line so far?
I think they were trying to throw a little spark in there and say, let's see if we can jumpstart things. But, you know, on the flip side of that, there was a game in Iowa, I want to say 2016, where they were a little bit banged up on the offensive line, and Rudolph went through several combinations just in that game. Within the game, he kept rotating guys. Maybe it was two guys on one side, two guys on another. So he has done that in game before. Now, part of it, the problem was yesterday it was really hot, but generally you don't see offensive linemen coming out. You see defensive guys. So, but I think they were just trying to send a message, quite frankly, that, hey, we're not moving guys off the ball as well as we think we can. Let's take a different look and let some guys look.
What is sort of your progress report on Alex Hornibrook? He's going to be a lightning rod. There's going to be tons of vocal critics one way or another, no matter how well he does. He throws a pretty big interception yesterday, and like a lot of guys, I'm sure that wasn't the game he was hoping to have. But has he developed to the point where you think the coaching staff is happy with him, or is this just right where he should be expected? How do you assess him so far?
I think he closed the season with a flourish last year. I thought he had a good spring. I thought he had a good camp. I thought he was solid in the first two games, considering that he didn't have Neville, Danny Davis, or Quintez Cephas. Those are three big weapons out of your offense, and they were still finding some things on the offensive line. The pick yesterday was bad. I think he threw it too far to the inside, and it appeared that Jake Ferguson rounded off his route at the top of the route. So that also helped allow that DB, or actually it's a linebacker who used to play safety, to get underneath it. But if he still throws it to the outside, it's probably just an incompletion and not an interception. You can't have that, especially the timing of it was critical, because you open the second half, it's 14-14, your defense makes a stand right away, you get the ball back. If you move down the field, you're in good shape. And that prohibited that from happening. He did not play anywhere close to his best game, but off the top of my head, I can rattle off 12 to 18 guys who had critical errors that contributed to the defeat as well.
Yeah, we didn't talk a lot about that, the way that affected the defense. They come out of the halftime locker room, they make that stand, and then suddenly they have a short field just a couple plays later. That was certainly a big swing. You had asked about this. You asked Scott Paul Christ's take on the end of the first half, where they maybe had a chance, if they had used some of their available timeouts, to maybe get one more quick offensive series. They'd probably had less than a minute to work with at that point. Did it surprise you at the time that the Badgers elected to just kind of let the half finish tied at 14?
No, I think knowing Paul like I do, he's a guy who kind of plays the percentages. He's, you know, one of the things he said after the game was, when I asked him, did you think about using those timeouts and what was your thought process, you know, that led to the ultimate decision not to? And he said he was basically straddling, like, okay, what happens if we do it? You know, do they go for something? Do we give up something? I thought, sitting in the press box watching it live before we talked to him after, that they were lucky to be back at even 14-14. They'd given up some stuff. They didn't look sharp at all in any phase. And I know someone had said to me, well, if you have faith in your defense, you make those, you call those timeouts. Well, no. That doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't have faith in his defense. For example, he's saying, we're going to go to the locker room at halftime, and our defense is going to come on the field, and we're going to stop, and we're going to get the ball back, which is exactly what happened. He plays the percentages. He's not always an aggressive guy. Sometimes it just depends. I've seen him be aggressive in some games, sometimes not. To me, coaches generally go by, are we in control? Are we struggling? If I make this move and it backfires on us, does it really hurt us? So I'm thinking, he's thinking, you know what? 14-14 at the half, I'll take that, given how shaky we played in the first half.
Danny Davis was fairly active. It seemed like he was a guy that Hornibrook was looking for on a pretty regular basis. His first game of the season, what was your impression of him, and kind of how the passing game, if it changed at all, having Davis available now?
It didn't change. What was telling was the first play they wanted to get him going. First play from scrimmage, they took a shot down the field to Davis. And Hornibrook put the pass over the defender, up high where Davis could go get it. He went up high and just dropped it. And that reminded me a little bit, and I said this before the game, of Nick Davis in 2000 with the shoebox suspensions. His first game back, he did a couple things, but he also had some plays that he normally would complete, but he didn't. And that could be rust. That could be trying to do too much. Especially that first play, Davis is going up there, he's thinking, I'm going to make a play. He's a sure-handed guy. He's one of the most sure-handed receivers they have. And he just dropped it. He had another drop as well that was negated by a penalty. So He was active, yeah. But if you read between the lines what Paul was talking about the wide receivers after the game, I think they think that he needs to do a lot better, and they anticipate he will. That's his first game, as Kendrick Pryor said. That's his first game since last December 31st against Miami.
Right. Do you expect – it's probably too early to say whether or not you think there'll be any changes in personnel, and I mean that in terms of experimenting with what they've got on the field, but also if losing a game impacts any of the redshirting situation, if, okay, we're not going to go undefeated or anything, so we're going to let a couple guys just – we know now that they're going to redshirt this year. Do you think there's going to be any evaluations like that, or is that not going to happen until we get deep into Big Ten season?
No, Paul doesn't think that way. They don't operate that way. I mean, the only personnel changes I would imagine you're going to see this week would be based on, do you have Andrew Van Ginkle and do you have Xander Neville? That would be how they'd have to tweak some things, because if you lose one or both of those guys going against Iowa, you're in trouble on both sides of the ball, because we saw, you know, what the deleterious effect it had against BYU. And you would think, and Iowa's a team similar to BYU, probably with, you know, some better pieces in certain spots, but their defense is similar, physical front. So you're going to need Neville to try to run the ball against that team.
I don't have a really good question to ask about Rafael Gaglione. I mean, he's been so good since, you know, for several years here, and he misses the kick, and he comes out, he spoke to reporters at length afterwards. He's a very level-headed, very good perspective guy. You really get the sense that this isn't the type of thing that's going to affect him long-term, even though he's obviously very disappointed with how it ended.
No, I mean, kickers by nature, you know, having covered teams for years, are a different breed, loosey-goosey. But if you look back at his career at Wisconsin, he had a really good freshman year, slumped as a sophomore. That was his worst year, and has been almost automatic since then, including the 7-of-8 performance a couple years ago when he had the season-ending back surgery. So 19-22 his first year. Then he has the sophomore slump, if that's what you'd call it, 18-27. But then 7-of-8, 16-of-18, and now 3-of-4. So he's missed kicks before. He's got 4 game-winning kicks. His performance against LSU a couple years ago was fantastic. I would not worry about him being affected mentally.
Yeah, I came into the game still the second best percentage of field goals made in school history, right behind Davenport. So definitely has left a mark. The silver lining, I don't know if there was one. I mean, I would have said Jake Ferguson, but now you're talking about his play on one of the key moments of the game, that interception. What do you look to? What are some of the guys that you say really did play well?
No one really jumps out. I mean, you had guys, you know, Scott Nelson thought he played poorly. Dakota Dixon talked about the mental error he had. You had wide receivers who didn't get open or didn't make catches. You had penalties at critical times. You had the special team, the return units gave up yards, punt returns specifically we're talking about here, hurt them by giving up hidden yards. The last one, for example, 14-yard roll on the punt. You start at the 8 instead of no worse than the 22. And think about where that last drive puts you. They drove, what, 68 yards, I think it was? If you're starting at the 22 instead of the 8, that's a significant difference, what you can do down the stretch on that last possession. So there was a game, I can't remember what the game was under Alvarez. Oh, 2001, Western Kentucky, the game that was postponed because of the 9/11 attacks and eventually played. It was just a blah game. It didn't do well on offense. He was particularly perturbed with that. No one got the offensive game ball of the week for that team. Just was unhappy. So I don't know who you really pick out from Wisconsin and say, hey, they played really well in that game.
Man, I was watching that game, and I just didn't believe at any point the Badgers were actually going to lose. Even when I guess I kind of thought that when they went down that last field goal, but I thought they'll drive again. I mean, they're clearly more talented because BYU played so well, and it was still just a one field goal difference. But I just was stunned afterwards, probably like a lot of fans, that it didn't go the way that the Badgers didn't somehow find something to win that game with.
Well, what was more surprising wasn't that they lost so much. It was the manner in which they lost. And we've alluded to this, you know, we discussed it already here tonight, is that when you have experienced guys on your defense, which is largely an inexperienced defense, making mental errors and not executing their assignments in the manner in which they normally do, that's going to hurt you. Now, Michael Dieter had a quote. He wasn't talking about the defense. He was talking about just performances in general, penalties, missed assignments. He said, if you continue to hurt yourself, shoot yourself in the foot, it's going to cost you. And if you do it a couple times, you can overcome it. But if you do it on offense, on defense, on special teams, generally if one unit is playing below par, maybe the other units rise up and pick you up. But there wasn't one unit that rose up in order to counterbalance the mistakes of the other unit yesterday. When all three are below par, you're going to have a chance of losing, and that's what happened.
So next up, like you said, is Iowa. Kinnick Stadium is a house of horrors for highly regarded Big Ten foes, although Wisconsin down significantly in the polls, so it's not going to be not going to fall into that category necessarily of the way top five teams have struggled there. You know, I imagine Iowa now will be favored maybe slightly in this game, and now for the Badgers, this would actually be a big confidence boost to bounce back and get that W on the road. What are some of the things you were kind of looking at in this, you know, in this matchup and the ways Iowa can give Wisconsin some problems?
Well, Iowa's defense lost some really good players, including Josh Jackson, who's playing for the Packers now, who had two pick sixes in this game last year. But their front, they run a four-man front, a lot of big bodies, similar to what BYU had. So if you're Wisconsin going in, if you don't have Xander Neville, I think they're going to have a difficult time establishing the running game. Wisconsin's defense, I think that if, you know, they were able to get pressure on Nate Stanley last year, the quarterback from Menominee, they allowed Iowa zero third down conversions and 13 chances. Based on what I've seen for the first three games from Wisconsin this year, I don't think you'll see nearly as much pressure. I think you'll see Iowa be able to run the ball more effectively, and I think Iowa is going to convert a lot more third down chances than they did a year ago or in the last several years against Wisconsin. So right now, if I had to pick a team that I think is going to win, I'd go with the home team.
Nate Stanley, one of multiple Wisconsin high school football connections on the Iowa roster. Before I let you go, any last thoughts, any things you're working on this week? Anything you're still interested in seeing out of this Badgers football team?
Well, this would be your first opportunity out of this year to see how they respond. I wrote a story for, it'll run Tuesday, so it'll be on our website tomorrow. Alex Hornibrook, who's normally a, you know, kind of flatline guy on the field and very dry, kind of, you know, not really excitable in post-game interviews or even interviews during the week. He simply asked a question about yesterday about, you know, how deflating can this loss be, or do you look at it that it's early in the season? And he kind of bristled a little bit, which I thought was interesting. He said to the questioner, he said, I don't view this as deflating at all. And I followed up and I said, well, why? And then he explained, look, he goes, it's if you think this is deflating because it's a, you know, so early in the season, and basically saying if you're going to sag and kind of shrink from the challenge, that's not the way people are in the locker room are wired. And it basically saying we don't want guys like that around, and I don't think they have any guys like that. But I got the impression he was thinking, you know what, it's way too early for people to start panicking or saying, you know, the season's lost, et cetera, et cetera. And I noticed that TJ Edwards last night on social media pointed out that he thought some people were jumping ship early, with just a subtle little jab on Twitter. So writing about that, about Hornibrook's comments, and it'll be interesting to see how this team responds. Because like I said, right now I pick Iowa to win the game.
Jeff Patricus, you can find all of his content at jsonline.com. Follow him throughout the week and, of course, on game day Saturday night when the Badgers take on the Iowa Hawkeyes. Jeff, we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, take care.
That's it for now on the Journal Sentinel Wisconsin Badgers podcast. Again, find us on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. Give us a rating and review. Let us know what you think. Happy to take 5 stars. That's certainly the goal. Feedback as well can be sent to my Twitter account at JR Radcliffe. Again, that's J.R. Radcliffe with an E on the end, double F and an E on the end. Hope you enjoyed the Wisconsin Badgers podcast. We'll catch you again next week, hopefully with some better news coming out of Kinnick Stadium in Iowa. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Stop.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.